So we started last week talking about the 20th chapter of Revelation. A lot of millennial thought centers around the 20th chapter of Revelation. And we're just trying to understand some things about this chapter. Remember, just very quickly, the book of Revelation was written in signs not to confuse people, not to obscure the information that God wanted them to have, but to make sure that they could get it in the easiest possible way. And we compared the book to kind of political cartoons, and we talked about how when you come from a different culture and you try to go back and read the political cartoons, it's not easy. Here's the one that we talked about. This is a political cartoon from around the time of the Revolutionary War, and you have America predicted or presented as the snake. You have, you have the Dutch and the Spanish depicted as dogs. You have France depicted as the rooster. And of course, England is depicted as the lion. You can see how hard it is to kind of grasp that political cartoon, because we're not familiar with it. But if you lived at that time, that would be an easy cartoon for you to understand. So it's written in signs. The book is really a warning to Christians that were then living to continue to overcome with Jesus. Don't give up. And to assure those that did not compromise their faith and continue to trust in God that he keeps his promises. And then to tell those people that the enemies of God would ultimately be destroyed. So we started talking about the 1,000 years and Satan being bound in Revelation 20, verses 1 through 6. We talked about how Satan is bound when he can no longer deceive nations. The reason that he can't deceive nations is because Jesus died on the cross. Remember, the biggest deception that Satan has, and he used it against David, is you don't have a sacrifice. God says he's forgiving your sins, but you don't have a sacrifice. And remember, without the shedding of blood, there can be no forgiveness of sins. Your sacrifice is just not sufficient. Blood of bulls and goats can't take away sins. But Jesus dies, and no longer does that deception work. We talked about how that 1,000-year period is demonstrative of just a long period, but it's a time-delimited period. We talked about the first resurrection, how that's our resurrection in baptism, to walk in newness of life, having been put to death. We talked about the second death, and again, the second death is after the second resurrection, when Jesus returns. Everybody participates in this second resurrection. Not all people participate in the first, because not all people are baptized. And those people that are baptized that have a part in the first resurrection, the second resurrection, of course, happens. And the second death is not going to affect those people that were Christians. So that brings us up to verses 7 through 10. Satan is going to be defeated. And God has to, as we said, provide assurance to his people that he is going to defeat Satan. So let's look at verses 7 through 10, and we'll read the whole thing. And then we'll go back and we'll talk about some specifics that are here in verses 7 through 10. When the 1,000 years are finished, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. He'll come forth to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to the war, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. They went up over the breadth of the earth, compassed the camp of the saints about the beloved city, and fire came down out of heaven and devoured them. The devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where are also the beast and the false prophet, and they shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. As I say, this is Revelation, the 20th chapter, is not an easy chapter to understand. You just have to have a unified concept of what this chapter is about. And there have been a number of different unified concepts that have been suggested. I'm just presenting my unified concept. You may have a slightly different concept. I can't be dogmatic that I know that mine is the correct one. What we need in order to combat these millennial theories, these fanciful notions, is a way of understanding what the biblical information is all about. So let's talk about this first concept, and it kind of centers around the idea that Satan is going to be loosed after this thousand-year period. Remember, this thousand-year period was a long time, but it was a finite time. It was time delimited. Thousand is generally used of just a long time. And we looked at the references to this idea of a thousand of something in the Old Testament last week. But Satan is loosed, and the way that you know he's been loosed is that he can deceive the nations again. Look at the way it says it here in verse 7. When the thousand years are finished, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and shall come forth to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth. So Satan is loosed when the limitation on his power to deceive is removed. What is it that bound Satan? It was the knowledge that everybody had that Jesus has died on the cross. And it's not just the death that binds Satan, but what binds him so that he can't deceive is that I know that Jesus died. I didn't see it. I wasn't there. But I have it on the basis of credible witnesses. It is true that when people stop looking at the credible witnesses, when they stop considering the biblical information, then they will forget that Jesus died. And if they forget that Jesus died, they put themselves back in the position of David. They're able to be deceived again. Is it possible that we're going to ever reach the point that the vast majority of people on the face of the earth have lost the knowledge about God and about Jesus and what he did? Well, I know that that time is coming. God says it's coming. I pray that we're not approaching that at this point. One day we will. I hate to say that one day we will get to the point that Satan is loosed. I hope that it's not now. I really don't want to live at a time when the world forgets what Jesus has done. It's too important to the way that we live our lives. It's too important to us that we remember. And I do think that there will always be some people that remember. God's always had a remnant. That's the way that God has dealt with people throughout time. Even when God says that Israel's going to be destroyed, he says, I will preserve a remnant. And that remnant, I hope, will persist even during this time when Satan is loosed again. I hope that we're not there. I pray that we're not there. But I also worry that people are forgetting about what God has done. The number of people who have read the Bible is sadly diminishing. Sadly enough, people tend to read books like Revelation. They tend to read that letter, but they don't bother to read all of the information that leads up to it. That's like reading the last chapter of the book and not bothering to read the first part of the book. And you draw some really weird conclusions if you skip to the end of the book and that's where you start reading. So I've said before, I have taught the entirety of the book of Revelation as a book, as a letter. It took 26 weeks. We spent the first 19 weeks talking about apocalyptic literature in general. We talked about Ezekiel. We talked about Daniel, a little bit of Hebrews, Matthew, the 24th chapter. We talked about 1st and 2nd Peter. And then when we had all of the background, we went through Revelation. And everybody, it was like a political cartoon. People said, oh, I know what that is. But people don't do that. And that leads to some problems. Now, the next thing that we need to discuss here in verses 7 through 10 is in verse 8. He says, Satan will come forth to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to the war, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And so people focus on this idea of Gog and Magog. And because when I look at the map of the earth, map of the world, the political lines that have been drawn, I can't find Gog and Magog. You know, it's even hard when you go back in time and you look at history to know what Gog and Magog are. But this is not the first time that Gog of Magog has been mentioned in biblical information. If you go back and read Ezekiel 38 and 39, especially if you remember the way that it's translated in the Septuagint and the way that it's found referred to in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it appears that Gog, some person named Gog, is the king of a country named Magog. So he is Gog of Magog, just like you would have Biden of the United States. So God is, Biden's not the king, but you understand my point. You have Gog, the king, Magog, his people. It's not some fanciful alliance that's going to be created sometime off in the future, and we don't know who these countries are, and the countries are made up of different alliances. I've heard some people refer to Gog and Magog as the alliance between Japan and Germany during World War II. I've heard it, Russia and the Muslims. I've heard all kinds of fanciful explanations here. But the thing that we can say, if you go back and read Ezekiel 38 and 39, and we don't have time to read those two chapters tonight, but Gog of Magog stands for the enemies of God's people. And they have allies. these enemies are not alone. They're going to find other allies to come with them. So Ezekiel talks about the allies of Magog as being Persia, which we recognize, Cush. Again, we recognize that. Not that we see Cush very often anymore in political maps. And he talks about Put and Gomer and Beth Togarma. I have no idea who some of those countries are. But he says, these are the people that ally themselves together to stand as enemies of God's people. And Ezekiel's message is the same as the message here in Revelation 20. They are going to be defeated. They're going to join together. They're going to fight against you, and they're going to be defeated. Now, some people read Ezekiel the 38th chapter, and they conclude that Gog might stand, or that Magog, excuse me, might stand for Babylon. I have no idea. I'm sure that those people understood what Ezekiel was telling them, just like people today. If we said the enemies of God's people are going to band together and they're going to try to destroy you, during the time of the restoration, the restoration we've been discussing on Thursday nights, a lot of people said that this was a reference to the Roman Catholic papists and made a lot of arguments that that had to be who Gog and Magog were. Well, I can't say.
Brother Dean?
Yeah.
Jeff Lentz here. I appreciate your invitation to join you all, since my home congregation was not able to. They worshiped at 4:30 my time. I'm out on the East Coast, and so I appreciate the opportunity to sit in tonight. I deal with this section in Revelation very simply. John has spent 16 chapters talking about how Satan raises up an enemy against God's people, deceives the people through the false prophet and the beast, wages war against the saints, and the saints cry out and they're told they have to wait and wait and wait. And then finally Satan is defeated. He spends 16 chapters on that. And then here in just a few short verses, it's like he recaps the same story. Satan is bound. Then he is loosed for a bit. There is an enemy of God's people raised up from among the world, and then he's defeated. I view this as John's way of saying the story that I've just told you for 16 chapters is going to repeat itself. I view this as the lather, rinse, repeat of Revelation. John is just warning that for future generations, Satan is going to be loosed again. He'll raise up enemies to God's people, whether it's China or Germany or Russia or Japan, you name the country, Russia, whoever. God's people will face enemies. They will be defeated by the power of God, just like in the Revelation in the story we've just wrapped up. And it's going to happen over and over again. That's why these nations are generic, like you're pointing out in Ezekiel. They don't represent anybody in particular. It's just a repeating pattern that I see John warning future generations, this is going to happen again. God's people are going to be persecuted by Satan. He's going to have some power. He's going to seem like he's winning. Then God will put him down. And you see that. You see over and over again, nations have risen up against God's people. They've tried to destroy the Bible. They've tried to destroy the church. And God puts those nations down. They go away. This, to me, is why this is such a short little section, because it's not specific to any particular set of incidents. It's just John's warning that this same pattern will repeat. God's people will suffer persecution, and God will emerge victorious.
Excellent point. And well said, Jeff. And by the way, we're glad to have you join us. I hope that your trip out here was uneventful and your stay is profitable and your trip back is uneventful.
Thank you. It's always good to find brethren.
Yes, it is. I might also add that there is an Alexandrian story. Alexander the Great is said to have shut up Gog and Magog in the Caucasus Mountains and built the Alexandrian Gate in a valley to keep them from ever being able to escape the place where he had shut them up. Again, it's just fanciful ideas. Persia, yes, I understand Persia. Kush, a little bit, but put Gomer and Beth Togarma, I have no idea who those are. Like you said, they're generic. They stand for the enemies of God. And here's the point. They will be defeated. He says in verse 9, they went out over the breadth of the earth. They compassed the camp of the saints round about, then the beloved city, and fire came down from heaven and devoured them. So here's what he's saying. Heaven is going to defeat Satan. The source of Satan's defeat is not the strength of Christians. That's not to say that Christian resistance is unimportant. James 4, James says, resist the devil, he will flee from you. I understand that concept that we individually and as a group need to resist Satan. But I think it's important for us to understand that without God's help, we would not be able to stand against him. Had Jesus not done what he did, and had we on our own strength of resolve decided, I am going to live the way that God expects people to live, following the Noachian precepts, even before the giving of the Old Testament law. I am going to live the way God wants me to live, and I will not give in to Satan. We would have been defeated had Jesus not died. In Luke 22, Jesus is speaking to Peter. And of course, he's been telling the apostles, watch. That's the theme of the last week of Jesus' ministry. Watch. Be on your guard. Be careful. Satan's going to try to defeat you. And then in Luke 22, at verse 32, there's the one of the tenderest statements in all of the Gospels. He said to Peter, Satan has desired to have you, but I prayed to God that you'll be preserved. The thing that defeats Satan has to come from heaven. It's this all-consuming fire that just burns up Satan and his allies. Now, that's not to say that we don't play a role in this. And we'll talk about that a little bit on Sunday. We'll kind of develop this idea. God is sovereign. That's absolutely true. But he tells us to pray to him. And sometimes I ask myself, if God is sovereign and he is all powerful and able to accomplish his purposes, why am I praying? So we'll talk about that on Sunday. That's just a little tease. Get everybody excited for Sunday. But I think the point is God is going to defeat Satan. He will not allow him to defeat us. And that's the encouragement that I need. God's on my side. The source of Satan's defeat is not my own strength. Thank goodness it's not my own strength, because I'm just not that strong. So, verse 10, next concept that we get to here. The devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone. This is the defeat of Satan. The lake of fire and brimstone represents destruction, not binding. It's one thing to bind the strong man. And that's what Jesus said he was going to do. In fact, it's what Jesus said he had done. And he said the evidence of that is that I've been able to cast out Satan's angels. Because I can cast out Satan's angels, you know that I've already bound the strong man. So just remember, as we go through this, I think of time in a linear fashion. First, this happens, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens. God doesn't think about time that way. Jesus has bound the strong man, and that wasn't going to happen until the cross. But as far as Jesus is concerned, it's done already. The evidence that it's done is I can cast out demons. So let's look at Ezekiel, the first chapter, and we'll take a little bit of time to read this. Ezekiel 1, let me get to Ezekiel. What happened to Ezekiel? There it is. I thought I'd made Ezekiel go away on my Bible program. Ezekiel 1. Now it comes to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kibar, that the heavens were opened. I saw visions of God. The fifth day of the month, which is the fifth year of the king of Jehoiakim's captivity. The word of Jehovah came expressly unto Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kibar, and the hand of Jehovah was there upon him. And I looked. Behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud, with a fire enfolding itself. Now, I don't know what that means, a fire enfolding itself, but there's this image of fire. There's a brightness around about it. Out of the midst thereof, as if it were glowing metal, out of the midst of the fire. Out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. This was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Every one had four faces. Every one of them had four wings. Their feet were straight feet. The soles of their feet were like the soles of a calf's foot. They sparkled like burnished brass. They had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. They four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings were joined one to another. They turned not when they went. They went every one straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, they had the face of a man. They four had the face of a lion on the right side, they four had the face of an ox on the left side, and they four also had the face of an eagle. Their faces and their wings were separate above. Two wings of every one were joined to another, and two covered their bodies. They went every one straight forward. Whether the spirit was to go, they went. They turned not when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, the appearance of torches. The fire went up and down among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning. Is that fire the way I think of as fire, like my campfire when I go camping? No. That's not it. This fire is just taken as great power of God. So you can continue reading here in Ezekiel 1, and it gets even more difficult to understand. The wheels within the wheels, and they don't turn. And goodness only knows, I can't figure out what that's talking about. Those people that read this in the century when it was written probably did understand it. But this lake of fire and brimstone, it's not a lake that's full of fire and full of brimstone, or some translations say sulfur. I don't know what it is, but I do know this. If I go to Revelation, the 21st chapter, which is a continuation of what we're reading now, and I look at verse 8, he's talking about this same lake of fire and brimstone. And he says, the fearful, the unbelieving, the abominable, the murderers, the fornicators, the sorcerers, the adulterers, the idolaters, and all liars, their part shall be in the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone. Then here's the point that he gets to a definition that gives me my understanding of the coherent nature of this. He says, this is the second death. Now, we've defined that second death as being put away from God, separated from God eternally. We're talking about essentially the idea of hell. This lake of fire and brimstone has been prepared for the devil and his angels from the very beginning. This is where Satan has always wanted to be. Now, it's really interesting to me that Satan, though this has been prepared for him, and he's been preparing himself to inhabit this all along, that's not where he wants to be. He wants to operate in the world where there are Christians. And why is that? Evil men don't want to live among evil men. They can't practice their evil if they're surrounded only by evil men. But the way that they practice their evil is to live among Christians and to prey on the Christians. I like to say that evil men want to steal from the Christians a place where anybody would want to live. Christians have it because they're preparing themselves for heaven. Satan doesn't want to live in hell. He wants to live among Christians. But this is the second death. He is consigned eternally to the place that's been prepared for him. And he will be there along with death and Hades. And remember, death and the Hadean world are resting places for disembodied spirits. It's as if when we die, our fate is sealed. We know where we're going to be. It's kind of hinted at in the story of the rich man and Lazarus. We find ourselves in torment And those that are righteous find themselves in Abraham's bosom. And they're comforted in Abraham's bosom. And then comes the day of final judgment. It's, in my mind, it's like sentencing. I already know I'm guilty. I've been judged at the point of death as far as my life. I know what I've done. And at that point, there's no changing what I've done. And I'm going to wait until such time as I'm sentenced. So I kind of liken this to a person who has been convicted of a crime, and he waits for his sentence in the county jail. As bad as that is, that's not the place that he's going to wind up. Once he's sentenced, he goes to a prison. And that's a very different place. That is a prison is an awful place. The county jail, county lockup is a bad place. I don't want to be there either, but it's not the hellhole that prison is. And that's really what it is, because everybody in prison has been adjudicated guilty of a crime. Now, I'm not going to comment on the imperfect justice system. And it is true that our justice system is imperfect, and sometimes innocent people are found guilty. I know that that's the case, but for the most part, those people that are in prison are there because they've committed heinous crimes, kind of like Shawshank Redemption. Once you remember the kid that said, oh, I did time in all these other institutions, Spofford and all these places, but then he finds himself at Shawshank Prison. That's the bottom of the pool. And remember the warden who says, you think you've got it bad now, you're living in that one, he calls it a one bunk Hilton. You've got a cell, and you're the only person that she says, you cross me and I'll put you down with the real bad people, general population. So this destruction, this second death, this is complete. This is absolute. It's not just bound. This is complete destruction. Death and Hades are here. Revelation 19 at verse 20 says the beast and the false prophet are here. Those that are not written in the book of life. The cowardly, the unbelieving, the abominable, the murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, liars. That's Revelation 20 at verse 21 at verse 8, where we were just reading. This is the second death. This is what's going to happen. And the early Christians needed to know that.
I like the way Paul says it in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 9. That
go ahead, Lenny, read that.
Let me get to it. These will pay the penalty of eternal destruction and away from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power.
Right.
And that's why John, when he penned this letter, I always think as there's victory in Jesus. And that's who we should be looking towards no matter what we encounter here in this life.
Right. So we are not going to be defeated. It's a just thing with God. to recompense punishment for those people that have prepared themselves for punishment, and to recompense a reward to those people that have prepared themselves for heaven. So, you'll hear people talk about Gog and Magog, and they've got all kinds of fanciful explanations. And they'll talk about the concept of 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things are a misinterpretation, in my mind, of the information that's here in Revelation 20. Closing thoughts. I'm sorry, again, I kind of dominated the discussion tonight. That's not the way that I like to teach.
Yeah, tell him I appreciated the way he did it step by step.
Kind of dominated.
The way he did it step by step.
Yeah.
But I want you to have a coherent, cogent approach to understanding the biblical. If you have a coherent, cogent approach, then people come up with all these fanciful explanations and you can defeat it because you have a coherent approach that makes sense. You're not picking these little pieces and phrases out of nowhere and stringing them together and coming up with something that ultimately doesn't make any sense.
I appreciated the way you went through it very much.
Well, thank you. We only have two classes left. We're going to do 11 through 15 next week. And then I will present, Lenny had asked me to do this discussion of millennial theories, and eventually I will get to a presentation of the fanciful millennial theories. So I'll show you a chart that typically people use that talks about the rapture and talks about this and talks about that. And I just want you to be exposed to it. I don't think there's a whole lot of value in trying to pick it apart, but I do want you to be exposed to it. So eventually we'll get to that, but it'll be the last week. And hopefully we will have built a coherent understanding of biblical information by the time we get to that. And you'll look at it and say, well, that's dumb. I don't mean to say it. That was a bad thing for me to say. I don't want you to get to the point where you sit down with your friend and they start talking about this and you look at them and say, well, that's dumb. Don't do that. But I do want you to be able to say, well, let's look at all the information. Let's try to put this together in some cogent fashion. And yes, I have looked at some people and said, well, that's dumb. And that shut down the conversation right there. So don't do what I did. Hey, this is truly unusual. I finished with 10 minutes to go. You can say that you were there when Dean finished on time. Every one of my students will tell you, no, that's never happened. Okay. If there's nothing further, then tomorrow night we'll be talking about the Restoration Movement. We'll be talking a little bit about Thomas Campbell and the Washington Christian, the Christian Association of Washington, and the Declaration and Address. And remember, tomorrow night we're going to be down to talking about the last of the propositions that Campbell sets forth. It's important to understand that that they were developing these ideas out of a background that did not include these ideas. So they had to come a long way. We get to stand on the shoulders of giants. Not that they began the church. The church has always existed. It's just that it at times the remnant was so small that you have trouble finding it. But it's growing in its ascendancy in the Americas in the years around the 1800s. So that's what we're going to talk about. We talked about Thomas and Alexander Campbell and their efforts, and we'll continue that tomorrow night. And then I guess the next time we'll be together will be Sunday morning. Anything else that we need to mention before we finish up this evening?